With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey listeners, Becky here. A quick content warning before we start. Today's episode contains discussions about films that involve sexual violence, Nazis, and war atrocities. If that's not for you, we completely understand. Join us again next week where we'll look at a movie that involves Diana Ross twirling in rainbows. And now, on with the show. A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film curator and historian Alicia Fletcher and Kayla Janisse. Kayla Janisse is a film writer, programmer, and producer, and author of several books like House of Psychotic Women, an autobiographical topography of female neurosis in horror and exploitation films. Her first film as a writer-director-producer, Woodlands Dark and Days Bewitched, A History of Folk Horror, had its world premiere at South by Southwest 2021 and won the highly coveted Midnight Audience Award. So, of course, we had to have her on to talk about exploitation films. As we discussed in the TV series, 1975 was a huge year for exploitation movies, especially in Canada. It gets technical, but what you need to know is that before 1967, the only movies in production in Canada, with a few exceptions, were being made by the CBC and the NFB. At the end of the 60s, two things happened. The first is that the national government created the CFDC, the Canadian Film Development Corporation, which would become today's Telefilm. The second is that at roughly the same time, a Montreal tax lawyer discovered a loophole that revealed that for every dollar you spent producing a movie, you could reduce your taxable income by 60%. This sudden influx of cash from multiple sources led to a boom in film creation. Some of them were highly lauded, Oscar nominees even, but most of them, generously, were not good. Then, in 1975, a young upstart filmmaker named David Cronenberg teamed up with Montreal production and distribution company Cinepix to release his debut film, It Came From Within, also known as Shivers. For a debut, it's everything we love about Cronenberg. So, of course, it has really gross body horror. How gross? Well, so gross that critic Robert Fulford wrote a review under the title, "You Should Know How Bad This Film Is. After all, you paid for it." He called the film an atrocity, a disgrace to everyone connected with it, including the taxpayers. If using public money to produce films like this is the only way that English Canada can have a film industry, then perhaps English Canada should not have a film industry. And this led to a debate in Parliament on whether or not Canadian films should be funded at all with public money. David Cronenberg was evicted from his apartment, and American Living in Canada super producer Ivan Reitman was almost deported. This was all settled by reducing the amount of government money invested and increasing the tax deduction rate to 100%, but that's a story for another time. Cinepix was one of the companies that really knew how to work the system, and they made and distributed both the films we're talking about today. And although one of them launched one of our most celebrated filmmakers' careers, the other is, well, Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS. But before we get into any of that, Kayla, you literally wrote the book, several books, in fact, on exploitation films. What do people love about them, and why do they make so much money? You know, we'll just start off with a nice, easy question.
Well, you know, exploitation films by nature are exploiting a topic, or they're exploiting a subject that's topical. You know, it's something that is tapping into public preoccupations and concerns. And they often do so much earlier than mainstream films do. So when it's considered too soon or too sensitive for mainstream films, exploitation films will kind of dive into them headfirst and do so with this kind of visceral sensibility regarding, shock and pleasure that they're not going to get in other more, so-called tasteful films. But the thing is, they are made to audience demand. you know? And so you can see that in the box office numbers. You can see that in the audience response to the films. And that's what exploitation films are. They wouldn't continue to be made about certain things or in certain styles if the audience was not responding to those things.
It's not my particular genre that I enjoy, although I am the first to admit that I now understand that not for me is different than not good. But a lot of these aren't good, but people still love them and they make these massive impacts and are very influential on filmmakers who do go on to make like these Academy Award nominated films and things like that. So there's something in them. People are finding what they need to be creative out of.
It's a lack of a filter is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's because in exploitation films, because there's less oversight, there's less budget, you know, so a lot of times you're getting ideas and concepts that are going right from a director's subconscious to you. You know, and there's nobody being like, well, maybe you shouldn't say that, or maybe you should rephrase that to, you know, to make it more tasteful. I mean, it's just right there. And often they're not necessarily thinking about a better way to say it or a better way to do it, you know. And so you're getting this really unfiltered message or vision from somebody. And that can be really refreshing and exciting to audiences, I think.
And I'm sure there's a bums in seats thing as well. It's like, did you hear about this thing? You need to see it because it's so shocking. It's so horrifying. And you go see it and you're like, oh no, that is really terrible. Why did I spend my money? But they've got your money. Yeah. They've got it already.
Having a film banned or, you know, viewed as unwatchable can often sell a lot of tickets. Still happens today.
Well, speaking of banned, in 1970, celebrated French-Canadian director Denis Arcand made a documentary for the National Film Board titled En et au coton about the textile industry in Montreal, specifically about Dominion Textiles, which around that time was one of the largest employers in Quebec. It was intended to be your standard life in Canada puff piece. However, work in textile mills was heading overseas for production, so the boards of these mills were crushing unions, exploiting workers, and laying off employees by the hundreds. So, famous leftist Arcand decided to do something different with his assignment. He said, the film board makes thousands of films to say that all goes well in Canada, that the Western wheat fields are very beautiful, that Glenn Gould plays the piano well, and that Paul Anka is an extraordinary star. So, I think it's just normal that there should now and then be a film which says that everything is rotten and that we live in a country that is corruption from top to bottom. Once completed, the film and its shocking interviews with both workers and executives, and that he may or may not have interviewed some members of the FLQ in 1970, was banned by the NFB until 1976, when it was released in a censored version. And the full cut wasn't actually available until 2004. So in 1975, what would you do if you wanted to hear real dialogue pulled from this banned film? Well, you'd go see Gina, a movie that is simultaneously about documentarians attempting to make an expose about a corrupt textile mill in small-town Quebec, and the assault-revenge plotline of a traveling stripper with ties to the Quebec mafia. Let's talk Gina. This movie is bonkers, and I love it so much, but I hesitate to say how much I love it.
You forgot to say that there's also a snowmobile gang.
Yeah.
Named Lake Penguin, which is wonderful, and they hang out in an abandoned ship. It's amazing, but before we get too far ahead of ourselves, Kayla, why don't you walk us through the brief plot summary of what Gina is about?
Well, I mean, it's basically, you know, a stripper who has been working in this small location where this textile mill is. At the beginning of the film, she has been discovered to have like run off with a customer and abandoned her post. And so Celine Lomez, who plays the lead character Gina, is put in her place, sent to this village where she's going to become the stripper at this hotel. And when she arrives, it's the same time that this crew of filmmakers is arriving from the NFB, which is called something else slightly different in the film.
Yeah, it's like the Ontario or the Canadian National Federation of Filmmakers.
Yeah, something like that. And but it's like one letter different, you know. But so this film crew arrives and she becomes friendly with them. And she even, you know, works alongside them as a translator, helping them to do interviews with some like Colombian imported workers that are at the mill. They are working, obviously, without permits, like on the streets, trying to get interviews with people about a union protest like 20 years earlier that had erupted in violence. And, you know, there's these kind of different threads happening, you know, there's this, the people who work in the mill, there's this like snowmobile gang, you know, that come up and they're like, hey, why don't you film us or whatever, you know? And so immediately this like friction is set up between the film crew and these various people, you know, so the only people that they have anything in common with, really, that they align with is Gina, who is coming from the same city as them. They're both coming mm-hmm. from outside, and they came from the city, and they have something in common. And so they hang out and play pool together and stuff. You know, so you have, you know, I've read a lot of comments about this film that talk about it like it's, you know, two different films, as though like Denis Arcand's documentary is kind of shoehorned into this mm-hmm. exploitation movie. But I actually don't see it that way at all. I see these different threads as being completely interwoven, and that this the strip sequence at the center of the film, because I do consider the strip scene to be the center of the film and not the rape scene. That strip scene is when all of the insecurities of class and gender and all the hierarchies and stratifications of these little societies, they all come into contact with each other in this room. And that is what is going to result in violence, you know, this contact. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of an amazing thing how the film is about exploitation. It's an exploitation film, but it's about exploitation, you know, and it's not just about the exploitation of the dancer, of the stripper, mm-hmm. and what happens to her. It's also about the exploitation of the workers, and it's also about lateral violence. You know, it's about like people who turn on their own people because they perceive these small inequalities, you know, or that, you know, like the two women who are contrasted in the bathroom doing their makeup, and they're talking about how much money they each make. There's just all these comparisons that are being set up throughout the film. And every character in the film is aware of those comparisons. They are making those comparisons themselves. You know, and at the top of all of it, you have like the big factory, the big textile factory. And these guys are untouchable, you know? So it's like mm-hmm. all the people who are the marginalized people. And yet even among all these marginalized people, they turn against each other in the wake of this much larger exploitation that's happening.
I thought a lot about that. You know, a lot of this film takes place at a motel mm-hmm. where the, you know, the CBC or the NFB crew are staying, where some of the workers live really close to and where Gina's staying. And you have these two, a married couple that run the hotel, that own it, a husband and wife. And there's a lot of attention paid to the wife character being exploited by her husband as a worker. Mm-hmm. Like she's basically the maid for the entire hotel. The husband is somewhat complicit in the rape that occurs during this film, because he's able to like not stop it and allow the snowmobile gang to break into the hotel room. And it's just every level of exploitation that you can imagine coming down to like, and I love that you pointed that out, like a dollar amount, like mm-hmm. that scene in the bathroom between one of the textile workers and Gina talking about how much money they make a week, which is then interspersed with like some of the interviews that the documentary crew are filming, with dialogue taken, of course, from Denis Arcand's real documentary, where she, mm-hmm. this textile worker, just says, all I want to do is be able to maybe one day afford a stereo and have a vacation in Atlantic City. Yeah. And then it directly cuts to like Gina dancing, which is, I mean, it's a little, you know, opaque, certainly. But I loved that. So I love that you don't think of it as two films with like a documentary shoehorned into another film. I think I agree with you on that for sure.
I find it interesting that the tagline is un film à fois humain et brutal. So a film at the same time, which is humane and totally brutal. And it is both of those things, because you like as much as you have to keep your distance from Gina the whole time because she's so closed off and has her own thing going on, you are cheering for her when like the terrible, terrible shit goes down. But when the terrible shit goes down, everybody's a bad guy, so you actually don't know who to root for. It's a very conflicting film, and I think that's the reason I like it so much, is because I still don't know how to feel about it, and I've watched it 3 times now.
Yeah, no, I am a fan, and I also think it really supports that, you know, that thing that people always say about genre films and exploitation films, which is that, you know, they say, well, genre films can always talk about things that other kinds of films can't get away with. And mm-hmm. the case of Denis Arcand is just the perfect example of that, because he made 3 films for the NFB that were either aborted or thwarted, and he turned all 3 of them into crime films in the 70s. Yeah. You know, so he had like Dirty Money, Rajan Padovani, and Gina are all coming out of documentaries that he had made, and then he wasn't allowed to do them for whatever reason. And so he just took a bunch of that material and put them into these crime films, where he could literally point fingers at the exact, like in Rajan Padovani, you know, it's been commented on that all the different characters are identifiable politicians and construction magnates and stuff like that. Like that people at the time would have recognized.
Celine Lomez is in that one as well, right?
The Celine Lomez. She has a small role in it. It's not a big role, but yeah.
I also like the cheap shots he takes at the NFB because the dweeb who works for like their national Canadian broadcasting, whatever, has like the worst facial hair and just kind of shows up with his glasses and is like, hey guys, I got to tell you to stop doing that thing. Yeah, I'm like, oh man, that's such a cheap shot.
It's a parody.
Yeah. I also love that Denis Arcand's brother plays basically him in the film. Yeah. These layers are not subtle, but they are definitely there. Same with the fact that the assault scene happens while they play the Canadian national anthem. It's like, oh boy. Oh
yes,
boy.
Yeah. That does occur.
All right. Now, Alicia, you saw this for the first time when I was like, we have to talk about Gina. Mm-hmm. It's 1975. Going in for it for the first time, what was your impression?
I was shocked that I had never heard of it. And I'm certainly not an expert the way Kayla is with genre, and it sounds like you know a lot about Denis Arcand. I kind of got really invested in the restoration history and looking at all the ways this film has been released throughout the decades or not released. And for me, I tried to avoid this, but I had to watch a dubbed version in English. So I couldn't actually watch the French language version with English subtitles. It just wasn't available. And so a lot of things, all the nuances that you're both talking about were translated differently in the English version. So like there is no, it's not the NFB, they're actually calling it the CBC. Hmm. And there's a line where one of the workers is like making fun of the filmmakers. And they're like, look, we don't live off of the CBC funds. Like it's kind of funny.
Well, I think that line is actually in the French version.
Okay, good.
So I think there's conflation happening, you know, to the people who work on the snowmobiles or whatever. They're just like, these things are all the same to them. It's like these artsy organizations, you know.
But I was blown away. I was shocked because, you know, knowing this has been called a rape revenge film, and it seems to be mentioned a lot in writing on that canon. It's so different than something like I Spit on Your Grave, which comes later. Yeah. The rape doesn't actually occur. This is about a 95-minute film. It doesn't occur until like an hour into the film, maybe even more so, longer. I think you're right, Kayla, when you say like the strip scene is really like the climax of the film in many ways. I felt like everything I'd read about this film going into it was incorrect. And so it's really an honor to talk to you, Kayla, because it's like, okay, this is like a voice of reason. Like someone who's actually, one, I think a lot of people writing on this film potentially haven't seen it. So when you look at like kind of 70s or 80s Canadian encyclopedias of film, I would question whether the people who wrote those entries saw this film.
Yeah.
And also I think it has a reputation that it both doesn't deserve, but at least that reputation might get people to actually watch this. Like it is very much an exploitation film, but it's also something else. Mm-hmm. I was just captivated by Celine Lomez. Mm-hmm. As soon as I hadn't put it together in my head, I realized, okay, this is actually one of the co-stars of The Silent Partner, which is a film I'm super familiar with and love, and her fate in that film is horrible.
Brutal.
Really brutal. Gosh, she was luminous. And doing a little bit of reading on her, I was like, yes, I understand why the producers of Charlie's Angels were like, you are too sexy for this TV show. And you cannot be on it.
We gotta dial the sexy back. Farrah Fawcett's about the level we want to go at. You're just a little too spicy.
I think she was auditioning for Tanya Roberts' role.
She was a pop star in Quebec at the same time, and she had a hit in 1974 that was Louisiana Zydeco inspired, which is just so delightful to me. And I love that she and her sister were pop stars all the way up through the 60s. And if you go on YouTube, you can see them perform together, and they're amazing.
Like she was like 15, I think, when she was topping the Quebec chart. So it also means that people watching this film in 1975 in Quebec recognized her sort of as a child star.
I think it's also very likely they recognized her as being one of the key people of the maple syrup porn movies.
Like she's in a pre-ski, also a called pre-ski. Like I can't remember the English title. It is, it's like
snowballing.
Actually, Kayla, that's something I'm actually really glad you brought up, because we probably will not get another opportunity to talk about maple syrup porn. Could you just run us through quickly about what exactly maple syrup porn is?
Cinepix as a company had started in the 60s. I mean, I guess if we backtrack just to the creation of Cinepix, because that will lead to that. Yeah. But it's like, so Cinepix started in the mid 60s. It was Andre Link and John Dunning. They both had come from film backgrounds of some sort. So John Dunning's family had owned movie theaters and Andre Link had come from distribution. And they formed a partnership originally to distribute films. So they were distributing films throughout Canada. When the CFDC was created, they decided they were like, well, we might be eligible for money to actually make our own film, you know? And so this is like in the wake of the Quiet Revolution. So it was like after Du Plessis had died and this mm-hmm. kind of more liberal government was brought into Quebec, and there was like more, you know, the church had lost the control they had. There was less censorship. There was more, you know, this idea of sexual freedom and this idea emerging of a real like Quebec nationalism and stuff. And so this is a very, there's a lot of change happening in this time. It's a very exciting time. And so they decided to take advantage of this and make a softcore film that also brought in a lot of these elements of like the of society in Quebec at that time. And they made this movie Valerie with Danielle Ouimet, and it was a huge hit. And so then they continued to make more of these films, you know, so they made that basically started the term maple syrup porn is something retroactively used to describe these films. But they were essentially softcore films that were made in Quebec in the wake of the Quiet Revolution in the late 60s and early 70s. Not all of them were serious. A lot of them were comedies, like sex comedies, you know, but you would have movies like, so Valerie is considered the one that kicked it off. And then there was like L'Initiation, which also had Celine Lomez, Loving and Laughing, which also had Celine Lomez, Deux Femmes en Or, Le Diable est parmi nous.
There's, these are great titles.
Yeah, there was just a bunch of these films, and it was kind of Cinepix's bread and butter up until the mid-70s when they sort of shifted more to horror. As other companies started making similar types of films, they felt like the market was a bit saturated with these maple syrup porn movies, and so they started shifting more to horror, and they had met Cronenberg around the same time, and so they started kind of nurturing him as an artist. And but yeah, it's like this unique period in Quebec history where they are these softcore films, but they are infused with a lot of sort of social commentary and political content just because of the time they were made. So it's not, I was about to say not like Porky's, but Porky's actually does have a lot of social commentary as well. So I shouldn't say that. But yeah, I mean, they weren't, you know, even the dumb ones, you know, still had like a, you know, like a purpose. They were really exciting to people. And I used to run a movie theater in Montreal. And whenever we would play one of these old films, the place would sell out. Everybody knew all the lines, you know, even though these movies were 40 years old, you know, everybody knew every line from Après-Ski. And so, and it really is an interesting thing to partake as an outsider from that culture.
It's who I always think of myself as, the outsider, even though trying to explain to Americans, I'm a dual citizen, a Canadian American, explain to other Americans at film festivals that there are two Canadian cinemas and there's two kind of Canadian cinematic histories. And so they'll sometimes be more familiar with Quebecois film than I am. Because I think, and I was trying to trace, like, okay, how was Gina released in English Canada? And I don't actually see in 1975 that it was. I don't see, I'm sure there it was in like a couple theaters in Toronto, but there wasn't like a wide release of a lot of these films. So I feel like as an English-speaking Canadian, I'm looking at these films now for the first time. They're like 50 years old, and it's as foreign to me as something like a Belgian film or, you know, a film from sub-Saharan Africa. Even though it's my own country's history and politics.
It's interesting because I have a friend who is Quebecois who knows a lot about these films. And I remember talking to him once about how I wanted to do a book about like Quebec cult cinema. And he was like, we don't have cult films. And I was like, well, you have this and this and this. And he was just like, those aren't cult films. Those are just the normal films. Everybody watches. And I was like, but to me, they're cult films. And he's like, but they're not. They're like the most popular films.
Sunday afternoon, throw on Gina. You're good to go. Lay boys, you know, or just watch it with grandma. It's great.
Yeah. But it was interesting because I was obviously coming from this perspective where, to me, moving to Quebec for a few years, it was like this floodgate had opened and there were all these films that I had never seen, never heard of. There was this entire industry, you know, and, you know, but to all the people there, I mean, they know all these films so well that it's often laughable to them when Anglos write about them, you know.
And it's only really when you get a crossover director like Denis Villeneuve or like Jean-Marc Vallée or even like, oh, dude, he did like Red Violin and 32 short films about Glenn Gould. That's another crossover, right? Like you're like, these are Quebecois filmmakers who were working consistently in there. I mean, how many people can see say they've seen Crazy, but they definitely know the rest of Jean-Marc Vallée's work, right?
So I definitely watched Crazy two nights ago and it is so good, but that's so off topic. I had never
seen
it.
But one thing I wanted to mention, though, is that you said at the outset that Cinepix, you know, that they had produced Gina. They did not produce it. They only distributed it. Yeah. So Jill Carl's company produced it. Jill Carl, who was the guy who made like Death of a Lumberjack. And he was married to Carol Lohr, who is interesting because she plays roles in his films that I feel are kind of similar to Celine Lomez's role in this film. In Gina. But yeah, but it was his company. He had started an independent company, and so he funded Gina. But then Cinepix would distribute movies for a lot of other companies. Yeah. And, you know, they were a lot like Roger Corman in that way, you know, so that the titles they distributed were often much more broad than the kinds of films they produced themselves. Like, so they had their roster of distribution titles was more broad in terms of its range or subject matter or quality or whatever, you know, like Corman was distributing like Bergman films and stuff, you know, which is not what we associate with him. But Cinepix was very similar where that, you know, they did distribute art films, foreign art house films and stuff like that on top of whatever they were producing themselves.
That's good to know. Do we know if Gina showed in France? I mean, obviously there's such a market in France.
I don't know.
Or, you know, Quebecois.
I don't know.
I don't know either. I couldn't find any. It's really hard to research this film, and it's hard to research a lot of Cinepix titles on outside of French Canada distribution, which obviously I would assume they're then selling third-party rights to foreign.
Well, apparently there was a version of Gina that played in Southern drive-ins without the film crew in it at all.
What? That's wild. How do you make this movie?
So it was a 15-minute film.
Well,
who does she play pool with?
I have not seen it,
scene?
But this is like in one of the books I had read, like a book chapter about, you know, just like Denis Arcand stuff, and this came up that, you know, the person who wrote this book mentioned that Cinepix had cut the film and sold it to Southern drive-ins without that whole part of the story. And it's like, or at least, you know, I'm assuming they're in it as characters, but they probably just cut out all the textile interviews and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So there was definitely an attempt to distribute it to other territories, and Cinepix was obviously not above trying to make it fit whatever the requirements of those territories were.
Because whatever you want to say about like Denis Arcand and like, you know, having to make the movies that he was able to make with whatever funding he could possibly get, he made them one hell of an exploitation film. Yeah. Like the back end of this movie, when I watched it with my partner for another show I did, I'd never seen it before. I didn't read anything about going into it. And when the final revenge happens, that like maybe 5-minute segment, I was holding his knee, he was holding my knee, and we were just silent. Then afterwards, we sort of looked at each other and went, oh my God, did that just happen? He just went through the wood chipper? Yeah. Oh my God. Like, it was just shocking. It's a shotgun blast.
I love when they throw the woman down the
smokestack.
Oh my ship. God. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's Sam Peckinpah level grandiose violence.
I've seen this described as the Canadian straw dogs, and I don't think they're wrong. Like, I think it's pretty close to that, just maybe without the pedigree.
Although this Gina takes a more active role in her revenge in this movie.
Definitely.
Yes, straw dogs definitely doesn't have that feminist kind of bent, that's for sure.
But Gina was fairly early in that regard, you know? Like, I mean, before this, it had been, like, Last House on the Left and Straw Dogs, and I think the closest you would get to women enacting their own revenge was often in foreign films. The ones I could think of were, like They Call Her One Eye, or the Swedish film, or the Jean Rollin film, Les Démoniaques. But it wasn't that common until after like 1975 that women were taking the revenge themselves. And it was like 1975. I don't know what it was about that year that would have changed things, but I know Susan Brown Miller's book Against Our Will came out that year in 1975, but it was really like 1976 and after. It was probably 75 to 85, you know, that you would think of as the key kind of rape revenge era, where women were getting revenge on men themselves, you know, and not having, you know, like Gina calls in the mob guys, but she participates in the last two.
She's the one who basically gets the guy in the wood chipper. Like that denouement is she's allowed to have it, which I was very happy to see. And I would say I can't think of an example pre 1975 of body in a wood chipper with the blood spurting out, blood and snow. I feel like that's also, Gina may have like kind of made that the iconic scene that you see later on in horror.
Well, I know for a fact that Tarantino is a huge fan of this, and I'm sure he has held screenings in his little private, you know, emporium that people have seen. I would not be surprised, because there's so much in this that's like, I've seen this in this movie, I've seen this in this movie, and how else would you possibly see it, right, if it's not that widely distributed? Speaking about intense violence, I guess let's move on to our next movie. So coming up, we're looking at one of the most notorious exploitation movies of all time. I'm gonna leave it at that. That's coming up after the break.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It was supposed to be a 9-day tit and ass movie. It was never supposed to be what it became, said director Don Edmonds when interviewed in 2009. It's an odd statement when, by sociology professor Lynn Rappaport's count, there are 44 torture scenes, but only 5 scenes that feature actual sex. The premise of Ilsa is pretty simple. Ilsa is the commandant of a small Nazi concentration camp, which is performing brutal experiments and torture on young women, and she's castrating the male prisoners of the camp after she uses them for her own sexual gratification, until she meets her match with a young, blonde-haired, blue-eyed American POW.
When I reached puberty, I discovered something about myself that set me apart from all the rest of the guys. I discovered that I can hold back for as long as I want. I still can. All night, if necessary. I guess you could call me a freak of nature. A sort of human machine. A machine that can set its controls to fast, slow, or never. And you want to know something? That never control just about drove her up the wall.
But despite that disturbing premise, Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS became a cultural juggernaut of a sort. It launched what looks like 3 sequels, a number of other imitators, and is one of several movies from 1975 that depict Nazi atrocities to lesser or greater degree of accuracy or sympathy. It's a movie that I had to take a couple run-ups to actually watch in its entirety. Alicia, Kayla, where would you like to start on Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS?
Well, I feel like Ilsa has been a part of my life for a very long time. You know, it's not a...
Yeah.
It was one of those films that, as a kid reading horror magazines and stuff, it would constantly be referenced. And I think as soon as, you know, I was a teenager renting movies on my own, I rented it. I mean, it was one of my earliest exploitation films I probably ever saw.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And so I think I'm immune to a lot of this stuff that other people... A lot of the other emotions that are riled up in people about this movie, I feel, you know. Also, at that age, I was a gore hound. You know, when I was a teenager, I was an unrepentant gore hound. I was not the most critical viewer. I was always just like, more gore, more upsetting. The more jarring or offensive a movie was, the more I wanted to see it. And so I would have seen Ilsa during that period. You know, it's an interesting film because, you know, for anybody who doesn't know, it's about a character named Ilsa who is supposedly based on Ilsa Koch, the SS officer, but not really. And so there's a square up at the beginning of the film, and a square up is a thing that is like an old staple of exploitation films where they sort of give you some sort of statement that's like a moral statement of some sort that's like, we feel compelled to show you these awful images so that society never repeats these kinds of atrocities again.
Yeah. It's a disclaimer.
Yeah.
Never actually is, though.
You know, but it was the kind of thing that, like, so many exploitation films would have, and it was like this false stance of moral superiority.
I'm shocked at the fact that it's listed under like Herman whoever the producer, but it's not. It's
Herman David Traeger. Herman Traeger.
Or David Friedman wrote it.
Well, but David Friedman would have had almost identical square ups on many of his other films, you know.
Gotcha.
I'm wondering if this is the only film which he used that name for. Although he did use pseudonyms. I mean, many of these guys use pseudonyms. Dave Friedman's career goes way, way back. He's one of the original, 40 thieves who were like these exploitation roadshow exhibitors, you know, who would like take movies on the road and drive across state lines and go to carnivals and fairs and like everywhere and show wild.
like the silent
show
era.
These exploitation movies and then get the hell out of town before the cops came. and so he has a very long and colorful career. So he is listed as the producer on the film. And it's interesting because he's also listed as the only producer on the film. You know, so Herman Traeger is listed as the producer on the film itself. But on like IMDb and stuff like that, David Friedman is listed as the producer. And it doesn't mention Cinepix as being anything other than the distributor, which in this case is actually not true. Cinepix is behind this movie 100%.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like John Dunning. And yeah, that makes sense to me.
How Ilsa came about was that David Friedman had been one of the producers on a film called Love Camp 7, which came out, I think, in 1969. That film was produced with the trio of Bob Cressy, who was a producer, Wes Bishop, who was a writer, and Lee Frost, who was the director. The three of them worked together, frequently making a lot of exploitation films in the 60s and 70s. Until Bob Cressy was shot in the 70s and then he dropped out. And then it was just Wes Bishop and Lee Frost working together.
Okay.
As one.
He had a really traumatic incident where he, so this is a famous story. I do not know how apocryphal this story is, but it is a story that survives. And he saw a cop hassling a prostitute on the street. He went up. And Cressy had this dog, like this big dog that he just loved. And he's got his dog with him. And he's like, if you don't lay off that woman, I'm going to sick my dog on you. And the cop shot his dog.
Oh.
Then shot Bob Cressy 3 times. And apparently Cressy was like hiding underneath a car trying to get away from him. And I don't even know if it was a real cop or someone dressed as a cop. Like, can't remember. But it was some kind of traumatic incident where, you know, he recovered physically, but he never recovered emotionally from this.
Yeah.
Nor would you, my God.
And so he stopped producing films. He became very paranoid, you know, and the remainder of his days were, lived out just in this weird, like in a hotel room, paranoid. But Lee Frost and Wes Bishop continued making films, and they made, you know, so they made very low budget films with Bob Cressy in the 60s, and then by the mid 70s they worked on the film Race with the Devil, and that kind of, you know, that transitioned them into doing more like AIP films, you know, so it was slightly cut above budget wise. Yep. but in the 60s they had made this film Love Camp 7, which was a Nazi exploitation film, and it's often considered like the first Nazi exploitation film. But it's extremely low budget, much lower budget than Ilsa. And it's obviously kind of pulling from this tradition of Nazi pulp novels and comics and things like that. So it's coming from a tradition that predates the Nazi exploitation films. Dave Friedman was also one of the producers of Love Camp 7. And Friedman had an interesting background in this regard, in that he had been in the Signal Corps in the Army during World War II. Which is the department that does film production and exhibition and stuff. And they would train people in film production and projection and all kinds of stuff. And so Friedman was not stationed overseas. He was back home, but he was on the receiving end of a lot of the footage of the liberation of the camps.
So he saw it all.
So, well, not only did he see it all, he swiped some of it and used it in an exploitation film in the mid-50s called Halfway to Hell, which, which him and Kroger Babb, who was another infamous exploiteer, they co-produced this documentary together that was supposed to be like a documentary about war atrocities, you know, like using this footage that he'd gotten. And they traveled around showing this film. And this would have been 15 years before Love Camp 7, even. You know,
wow.
And this is a Jewish guy, making this
right.
film also. Yep. Right? So Love Camp 7 then goes to Cinepix. They are the distributors in Canada of Love Camp 7. And they have minor success with this. But that was not the movie itself that like prompted Ilsa to be made, because Ilsa wasn't made till 5 years later. So it wasn't as though they turned around and were like, mm-hmm. oh, this is a winning formula, you know? So it actually was, I think, more likely to be The Night Porter that was the inspiration.
Yeah, I was going to say.
The direct inspiration for Ilsa, because supposedly John Dunning had been approached by somebody from Europe, you know, like with the idea that like, you know, these movies are hot right now. You should make one of these movies. And the only way I could see somebody saying these movies are hot right now had to be because of the controversy around The Night Porter that was swirling.
Yeah, which is, just for listeners who might not know The Night Porter, it's 1974, very infamous film starring Dirk Bogarde and Charlotte Rampling, directed by Liliana Cavani. We're going to talk soon on an episode in the season on Seven Beauties, another Italian director who's taking on the Holocaust, female director. I just watched The Night Porter for the first time to prep for Ilsa. Mm-hmm. Like, I'd watched Ilsa and I was like, I need some context to understand.
So where is this coming from?
Glad you're bringing this up. I mean, I'm very conflicted on The Night Porter. I absolutely loved it. You really have to see it to understand what's achieved in this film. I think 50 years later, people are still upset by it. But that makes sense to me, Kayla, that it's more The Night Porter that would lead to a 9-day shoot for Ilsa, mm-hmm. She-Wolf of the SS. That makes sense.
So Cinepix had the idea, like, okay, we want to make a Nazi exploitation film, but John Dunning also really wanted a female villain. He wanted to make an iconic female villain. So he went to John Saxton, who was a University of Toronto English professor who made documentaries on the side, and he had made a documentary for Cinepix about Stompin' Tom Connors.
Right, right, right.
And yes, it was cheap and done quickly, and it was an easy production for them, you know. So they liked him, and he said, well, you know, if you guys ever want screenwriters, I'd be interested in doing that. And so I think this was the first thing they brought to him and said, well, what about this? Why don't you write something that's like a Nazi movie with a female villain? And so John Saxton turned out this script for Ilsa
professor turned out the script for Ilsa. Yeah. I record this on U of T campus.
Oh, really?
Currently, so viewers know. Like, I'm one block away on St. George Street.
Just out of curiosity, how much of this do you think is affected? We talked about Gina previously about where women's lib, quote unquote, second wave feminism was at. Do you think that's an inspiration? I saw them referring
Absolutely.
To Ilsa as not a woman's liver, but she's definitely in that camp,
yeah.
if you will.
Yeah.
And then I also saw, we'll talk about this in a minute, I'm sure. She's now like a feminist icon in some circles, which is fascinating to me.
Like, I interviewed John Dunning literally on his deathbed. It was the last interview he ever did. He was like dying in his living room, connected to equipment. And I had been sent there to do an interview with him for an award that he was being given. And he talked very proudly of Ilsa. He was very proud of the film because he wanted a female villain. He wanted a female character. He wanted a strong woman. And he felt that, to him, that was what Ilsa was about. You know, it was like in mm-hmm. this framework of a Nazi exploitation movie. But to him, it was all about her. And it was all about centering female pleasure. And her pleasure is a key part of the plot, you know?
Yes. Just mm-hmm. so for people who maybe are not watching this film, she's a commandant in charge of a medical sort of experiment concentration camp. And every time she sleeps with the male prisoners, she then castrates them the next morning so that they can never sleep with another woman. And her pleasure is pretty front and center, like you're saying, Kayla. And she's, I'd say, insatiable would be...
I was about to say insatiable is the word I would use, yes.
There's a lot of medical experiments on female prisoners as well. You know, syphilis is injected, a lot of diseases, things. It's a lot.
Right, but even, I was just going to say, like, the experiments themselves are also based on her theory that women are tougher than men. So her whole theory is that they can endure more pain because she wants women to have higher ranking positions in the SS.
For 3 nights, Gerard. And all this without a single cry. No man could have withstood such pain. She is the proof of everything in my theory.
This is where I realize Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS has a lot in common with 9 to 5 and Private Benjamin.
I was literally thinking
which
that
was not something I
this.
Thought.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a very funny analogy.
You're not wrong.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong. And it's interesting because it's like when you actually think about, well, what is the purpose of her experiments? Her experiments yes. are actually supposed to prove the strength of women because she feels that she's not taken seriously by the chauvinistic yeah. men in the SS. And she it's in, so her motivation is to prove that women are tougher than men.
And she proves it
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
Because there is that one prisoner who is endlessly tortured. Yeah. She's kind of like the lead character in terms of the female prisoners. And she doesn't break.
Yeah.
And you know, we don't want to spoil the end of this film for our listeners, but you know, she kind of gets her own, it's yeah. a bit of a failed revenge, but she's a very important figure in this film.
Yeah,
yeah, I do. I mean, I understand, Becky, like the question, but I do think she's feminist. I'm not saying this is a feminist film, but I'm understanding that this, in the context of 1975, female villain, what John Dunning was trying to achieve, which I think he did achieve. If you know that going into the film, I think it makes the film a little more tolerable for people who are not initiated into exploitation and specifically Nazi exploitation. And Diane Thorne, to me, as an actress, I find fascinating, endlessly fascinating.
I mean, she's no slouch. Like, one of the biggest reasons is not the naked women. It's not all that. It's the fact that she is really, really good in this role. And she trained with Stella Adler. Yeah. So, like, same person who was training Marlon Brando and, like, one of the greatest acting teachers of all time.
Her on-screen debut is a short film in 1965 called Encounter, that co-starred Robert De Niro, who was also a Stella Adler follower. So, I mean, that's incredible when you think. And then, you know, the 70s kind of comes around and she isn't getting the roles that she wants. She's a very highly trained and accomplished actress. I read that she has a PhD in comparative religion.
That, from what I understand,
right.
that is up for debate. She
yeah,
says
okay.
she does, but that is up for debate.
Fair. But yeah, she really wasn't getting the roles that she wanted in the 70s. So like, this isn't her first exploitation film. There are others that come before.
And she was a Vegas showgirl too. Like that's she got the looks and the brains.
Wasn't she? She's, I just love her. But she, you know, she read the script and was like, this ain't good. But she does. She performs. She delivers. And this is a 9-day shoot, which is crazy. Sometimes feels more like a 6-day shoot. There's like, I think one critic I was reading was saying, you know, it's supposed to take place in Germany. And you can kind of hear the LA freeway in the background at certain points. Like, it's very Los Angeles in terms of its setting. She is, like, I understand how this became such an iconic character. Mm-hmm. I understand how it spawned sequels. Like, this makes sense to me because of her and almost her alone, and probably with John Dunning also being such a fantastic producer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting with John Dunning because, you know, Andre Link's the business guy. John Dunning's the creative guy. Yeah. I have never heard anybody in any interview I've ever read say a bad word about John Dunning. You know, like, everybody... Yeah. loves him and found that he had such integrity. The only person I've ever read anything bad about him from is Dave Friedman, who's the co-producer of Ilsa, who in his interviews, he talks about CinePix very disparagingly and saying like, oh, they couldn't produce a phone book, you know, and how like he says he was the one who found the Hogan's Heroes set that the, you know, because the film is shot on the
yes.
set of Hogan's Heroes.
Yes.
That, so Dave Friedman says that, you know, he was the one with that hookup and he's the one who had that idea to do that. And that CinePix was always late sending money and that they were at some point asking him to pay the crew, even though he was a hired producer. And so he just talks about them like they're totally incompetent and he had to do everything. But I take that with a grain of salt because, like I say, I've never heard anybody say anything bad about John Dunning, and I cannot say the same about
yeah.
Dave Friedman. So.
Yeah. There should be more about John Dunning in the history of Canadian cinema outside of exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
He shouldn't be just relegated to like that history.
Yeah.
Like, he's an important, very important producer, period. And he made Ilsa.
Yeah.
I think this is also a good time to talk about kind of how this got as wide a release as it did.
Mm-hmm.
Also because there was a lot of X-rated films like Deep Throat being showed in regular cinemas. And this played in downtown New York, I believe, for a couple weeks.
It played on 42nd Street for 6 months, is my understanding. Which
6 months?
Yeah, 42nd Street, like the stretch that would be known as the Deuce, where you had a lot
yeah.
of porn theaters, you had a lot of sex workers. Like, it was a really important moment on 42nd Street in 1975.
Well, but they also had tons of like kung fu movies and action
yep.
film. I mean, it
yep.
was all the genre films, all the what people consider lowbrow genres, but all the genres.
The films that are not going to get reviewed by Vincent Canby in the New York Times.
Which Vincent Canby did review this, though, eventually. As well as a bunch of others. He was like, here's all the bad movies that are coming, and Ilsa was along with one of them.
He did not, let's just say he walked out at a certain point. But 6 months on 42nd Street, and it made a shit ton of money, which is...
Yeah,
I get it. I do get it, because I think, as coming back to the beginning of this episode where we're like, if you say something is, it's unfiltered, it's X-rated, you shouldn't be seeing it, then that's going to sell tickets. Mm-hmm. And what's more 1975 The Deuce than Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS?
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to say it's one of those movies that I will spoil it because I don't care. She dies at the end. Ilsa does not survive this film. She gets shot in the head by another Nazi who's trying to clean up all the mess.
She dies, but that doesn't stop Ilsa from not appearing in two other 1976 and I think 1977. She still has two sequels, which is Ilsa, I'm going to get it wrong, Kayla, you're going to know it, but Ilsa Harem Keeper of the Sheiks?
Harem Keeper of the Oil Sheiks.
And what's the Siberian one?
Tigress of Siberia.
Jesus
Christ. And that one's actually is filmed in Montreal. And there's a hockey team in it.
Great.
That is the most Canadian of the Ilsa movies. But then there's also an unofficial, licensed Ilsa movie that Jess Franco made. Ilsa the Wicked Warden.
I saw that one, where she has red hair instead of blonde hair, but still the same amazing 70s but haircut.
Wasn't that one originally called Wanda the Wicked Warden, and they just dubbed over the name Ilsa in place of Wanda because they wanted to release it as an Ilsa?
I'm not sure, because from what John Dunning says in his book, there was a license agreement of some sort. Between the companies. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, you would think so, because the story is so similar that you would have
to. So I don't know why it was called Wanda the Wicked Warden in Europe. If they were licensing the name Ilsa, why would they change it to Wanda? I don't know.
Yeah.
But
maybe because of the UK video nasty that they couldn't get Ilsa in at all. So maybe this will slip under the radar.
Maybe. That's a good theory. Yeah. But coming back to Diane Thorne, who, kind of has described the shoot as grueling, which I can understand, and maybe not so pleasurable, but she really embraced it, after the film's release and until the end of her life, which really was just, I think, a year and a half ago that she passed away, really, really embraced the Ilsa character. She'd show up to horror conventions in very S&M garb. I had emailed her in preparation for the show. We wanted to get Ilsa the She-Wolf of the SS onto the actual TV version of this podcast, and that was a no bueno. Would be it wasn't going to work. So we saved it for the podcast. But I had emailed her in her Las Vegas chapel, because she was running with her husband, her longtime husband, a wedding chapel where you could get married by Ilsa. Which is amazing. And,
insane.
Got a very, very polite response from her husband, just saying she wasn't doing interviews at this time. She did pass away a month later. Yeah. So that kind of
And her husband,
sense.
Who she met on Ilsa.
Yes.
One of the
her Jewish husband. Yeah. Her Jewish husband who she met on Ilsa. That is. And they were married for nearly 50 years, which is, I think, as sadly, when an actress or a performer passes away or an artist passes away, it just takes that for them to become really iconic. And I feel now that she's passed, Ilsa's only going to grow bigger and bigger, potentially, which is amazing for a film that's nearly 50 years old. Yeah. That still shocks. It still shocks. When I say it was hard to get through, but I still really appreciate it, I really mean I had multiple, you, Becky, had to pause, go get a glass of water.
Come back. There's a few points. There's a few points that I actually was like, you know what? I can't look at
and
this.
And that's just us.
I'm good.
But
it's weird because I'm not squeamy. There's some movies that I'm Serbian film, I didn't make it through because I was not for me. So, something about this one just really got under my skin and just started clawing, and I did not care for it.
I think that's good, though. I think that's good. I think if... this is very different than when we're going to talk about Seven Beauties in a couple weeks. What do you want from a film like this? That's the thing about Ilsa She-Wolf the SS. Do you want to come out of it and be that was, I learned a lot?
That was fine.
I was fine.
You want
a film that's a Nazi exploitation film that takes place at a concentration camp where women and men are tortured. You want to be uncomfortable.
I'm going to sound judgmental here. If you are turned on by this film, perhaps there are some questions you should be asking yourself.
But people said that about The Night Porter too, right? So it's okay. I get what you're saying. I do get what you're saying.
Although The Night Porter is a clearly far more actually intentionally erotic film than Ilsa. Ilsa's eroticism is very cartoonish. There's a lot of stuff about Ilsa that's very cartoonish. Exploitation films, they tend to you know, one of the things about exploitation films is that they exaggerate everything. They make everything into a worst case scenario. But how do you do that with the Holocaust? Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
And this is one of the things like that people have been debating whether it's appropriate to ever try to depict the Holocaust in any movie because of that, you know, like even Claude Lanzmann, who made Shoah, even denounced Schindler's List, you know, as being tasteless and offensive and that this should never have been made, you know. So what do you do with a movie like Ilsa if that's the if that's the idea, you know? And I think the only way that you can look at these films and like look especially at like Nazi exploitation in general is like the continued appeal of like the Nazi uniform and the Nazi rallies and all these things is, you know, there was this author whose name was like Mary Elizabeth O'Brien, who had written this book that was all about the Nazis' program of enchanting reality. You know,
interesting.
This idea that this reality was completely engineered to appeal to sensation and emotion and to hide the true purpose of what they were doing. And I feel as though exploitation films and this conflation of like deviant sexuality and fascism and all this kind of stuff. I mean, the reason why it works is because the very foundation of so much of Nazi ideology is built on fantasy and enchantment. You
That's
know?
A great point. Yeah, I was reading, no, Susan Sontag never reviewed Ilsa, She Wolf, the SS. I really wish she had. But I did find an article she wrote in 1975 kind of talking about, I think she was reviewing a play that was kind of considered Nazi exploitation. And she pointed out that like if you just walk down 42nd Street or even like more high streets in New York City, you saw the kind of Nazi regalia like really in fashion. You saw it in not just in sex shops, but like that kind of fetishism had become so popular and actually mainstream in 1975 that that made sense to me then that how Ilsa could play for 6 months, you know, in New York City. And even I think Diane, I think it's Diane Thorne who said, kind of explaining, because when you talk, when you find interviews with Don Edmonds, he just doesn't really talk about this film. He just says like, whatever, don't ask me about it. Like I got paid. I made it, whatever. I appeared on Green Acres and Gidget and that's it. He was an actor before he was a director. But Diane Thorne kind of in the 2000s said like, you have to understand in 1975 that they really, really felt that's what happened under Nazism and the Holocaust was far behind them, that it could never happen again. There was this like very, this like kind of element of safety that they felt away from that history, which we no longer have in 2021. Like we don't have.
I'm like, that's very optimistic. It's gone forever.
It's naive, certainly, but I understand the point she was trying to make that, you know, in no way, if you thought Nazism was going to rise up again, would a film like Ilsa, She Wolf, the SS exist in that kind of cartoonish way that it did.
Okay, then I think that's probably the best place to leave it, maybe on an up note. I want to thank Alicia Fletcher once again. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thanks,
Becky.
This was challenging, but I somehow had a lot of fun. Should I be concerned about?
I think when you talk about these in an intellectual sort of way where you understand where they're coming from and what the time period was, which is what this podcast is all about, that's the way to talk about these films. The context. It's all about context.
I also just love Ilsa's hair so much. Like, it's like if Vidal Sassoon
no fashion icon
had like a Nazi commercial, it would be Ilsa, basically.
Kayla Janice, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me on. And making me revisit these movies that I hadn't seen in a long time. So
I gotta say, when you mentioned you already had seen Gina and had a copy, I was like, oh, we can be best friends now.
I knew there was only one person we could ever ask to be on this podcast, and luckily I knew her, which was good.
Okay, and you can join us again next week where we're going to be looking at one of RuPaul's favorite movies. Are You a Winner, Baby? That's coming up with special guest Carolyn Morissette next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoy the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, @Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cam Maitland. Today's episode featured Kayla Janisse and Alicia Fletcher as guests. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.